Brian.
Heather, how are you?
I'm doing very well. How are you doing?
Superb.
Oh, it is a beautiful day here in Brooklyn. We are like 90 degrees and sunny.
It's about 51 in Alameda, but it's sunny.
What is going on with that?
I don't know. But it's the coastal influence, I guess. But I'll take it. It's a beautiful day.
Definitely, indeed. So we've got a good farm report coming up today.
Yeah, I'm excited for today's report. I mean,
well, for you, especially with Mr. Alec Bradford, that must be interesting to you to hear about him and his operation down in Virginia, right?
Oh, absolutely. I think, you know, I have my educational background's in Greek and Roman archaeology.
Huh, there
and
you go.
The white cattle are mythical throughout ancient mythology. And the white cattle, actually, that the ancient park, or ancient white park cattle that they're raising down there in Virginia, have antecedents in the ancient Roman world. And one of the theories about the British white cattle is that they were brought to the United Kingdom by the Romans about 60 years before Common Era. And that's one theory.
Well,
and then, as with all these things, there are many theories.
Definitely. Well, just by looking at them, you could tell they almost seem like a mythical creature just by their, you know, the breed themselves. That's what they look like.
Yeah.
Unlike anything else.
Pretty fascinating just looking at some ancient depictions of cattle, and you do see the cattle skulls a lot of times in Roman, especially sculpture, have horns like the ancient white park cattle. So it's pretty cool. I mean, it really does look like something pretty primeval.
Definitely. And have you had a chance to taste that ancient white park?
Not yet. I'll tell you what, though. I'd sure like to.
We'll figure out a way to make that happen for sure.
Yeah, maybe I can hook some up when I'm out in New York in June.
But, yeah, that would be great if you guys can meet.
Yeah, that would be really cool. I think that one of the fascinating things about our two guests today, Dave Metzger and Alec Bradford.
Doug Metzger.
Is that they're raising, you know, heritage breeds. And there's a lot of stuff going on right now with our food supply and the industrialization of proteins. And as recent events with swine flu show, animals can be vectors for all sorts of diseases. And in some of the industrialized confined situations, the wrong disease could wipe out the entire food chain. So one of the things that's very important about heritage breeds, in my mind, is that we're increasing the genetic diversity in terms of our livestock
population. Keeping biodiversity alive in the food supply.
I don't think
anything can be more important than that.
No, and I think that, you know, it's all these events. I mean, this summer in 2008, the, you know, $6 corn and $5 diesel pushed the issue about grass-fed beef in a lot of places, and certainly alternative production in other kinds of livestock and poultry. And I've always been concerned about the headlong march toward monoculture. And so, you know, I think it's very fitting today to have Mr. Metzger and Bradford on the show.
Yes, and I definitely look forward to having people listen a little bit about Alec and his operation and see how it's similar to Hearst Ranch's operation with the grass-fed on the east and west coast of our country.
Hearst rocks. You rock, Brian. You're number one.
Wow, double fierce. I'm double fierce today.
You know it. So thank you so much for taking the time out of your Sunday to introduce our farm report.
Hey, it's my pleasure as always, and I wish you guys the best, and you sound great today.
All
as
right.
always.
Thank you. Thank you so much for listening, and you know, we're a big fan, and you're a big fan of ours, and we will be talking to you real soon.
Okay, happy trails.
Hi, and welcome to the Heritage Radio Network Farm Report. We're broadcasting here on a Sunday, April 26th, and it's a beautiful day in Bushwick, Brooklyn. And we're here with Alec Bradford from Leaping Waters Farm in Shawville, Virginia. And as we usually do here with the Farm Report, we're going to ask him 20 pertinent questions and hear from one of America's leading farmers. How are you, Alec?
Hey, how are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Thanks for joining us here today on the Farm Report.
Yeah, sure.
So we just want to get a basic idea of what you do over at Leaping Waters, what you farm, and what your duties are as the head farmer.
Okay. We run a 325-acre pastured beef, dairy, and poultry operation. We raise a rare breed of cattle called Ancient White Park cattle. About 500 of these animals in the United States. There's probably 1,200 worldwide. We have about 80 head of cattle right now. We have large black pigs, which are also a rare breed. They're a British pig. They get to be about 600 pounds. And we raise the pigs and the cows together on grass down by the river in southwest Virginia. And after the pigs and the cows get off the grass, we take chicken tractors and run the chickens over the top of where the cows and pigs have been in order to refine the soil and get some of the parasitic bugs out. And then we take all the meat that we process here and we sell it to local restaurants. We distribute it through Heritage Foods, and then we give some away to the food banks locally to try to get some of the more less fortunate people to get some good food as well.
Wow, well, it sounds pristine down there. Just the name of the farm conjures up some vivid imagery here. What's the history of this land?
Going back to way back, it was a Cherokee hunting ground. We've my son and I have found quite a few arrowheads and spearheads up in the high fields and in the forest. And the Shawnee Indians also came through here. We're very close to where Laura Ingalls was kidnapped in the 1600s or 1700s and taken back to Ohio. But for the most part, it was Cherokee land. After the Civil or after the Revolutionary War, pretty much all of Montgomery County, Virginia, was given to a colonel in the Revolution named George Hancock, who was buried not too far from here in a tomb. He was buried standing up so that he could watch his slaves on his plantation after he died. It's a local legend, but you can go and see his bones still, actually. After that, after the Civil War, the plantation was broken up into really small tracts, and there was a couple hotels were put in down here. We have a lot of mineral springs that the wealthy northern folk would use to come down in the hot summers and vacation and bathe in the springs and play a little pasture golf. And I guess when probably the 1930s was the last of the hotels burned down. And since then, it's pretty much gone into a state of disrepair. The family we bought it from had the land in their family for 200 years, but they hadn't taken really a whole lot of care of it in the last 40 or 50. It was pretty much a junkyard when we got it. We spent maybe a year just cleaning it up. But it's prime land. It's about 120 acres of it. It's just perfect bottom land. It's all the soil is like cake batter. It's solid black. It's beautiful.
How'd you become connected to this part of the world?
Well, I was born in southern Appalachia in Tennessee, just a little south of here. That's where I grew up. I moved all over the place before we actually bought this farm. I lived abroad for a little while. I lived out west. I lived in the city, actually, for a couple of years. And I met my wife, and she decided that we needed to farm. And I'd been working on a farm when I was a kid up until I was 19, so it seemed pretty logical for me to come back. I don't know, the mountains around here, they leave a mark on you if you spend any amount of time, especially in your childhood. They throw a pretty long shadow, so it wasn't too hard of a decision to move back.
Huh. Well, you seem to have a very poetic way of speaking about the land you're connected to.
We love it.
So to get to less sort of ethereal talk, if you could write one farm issue into law, what would it be?
That's rather complicated. I don't really have a whole lot of use for the government in my operation. it seems like a farmer of my size, we're not considered big ag, so we have, if we want to sell meat directly to the consumer, well, there's a whole lot of hoops to jump through. But I realize that given the size of big agriculture and the number of people that we feed in the United States that we have to have some government regulation. But I guess if I had to choose one thing, I'd probably get rid of the current standards for organic certification. I think we should probably start over with more focus being placed on making a solid connection between farmers and consumers. Right now, the standards we have serve as a vehicle mostly for retailers to push more boxed meat through, which effectively lowers the standards of everyone that wants to buy like quality food. I don't know if you need to personally know your farmer and have him be certified, but it helps. And I guess you should have a real sense of what their practices are, at least if you're gonna get involved in the food movement.
Uh-huh. Now, what are the members of your production chain that you interact with most, and which are most important to your survival?
The abattoir is most important to my survival. I raise these animals. I try to get them, you know, as close to perfect as I can over a two-year period. And if I take it to a slaughterhouse who does shoddy work, they can destroy all my work within 30 seconds. So if I can't find somebody who can properly process the beef, treat it humanely, label it well, cut it well so it looks good, then I'm out of business pretty quick.
So speaking of maintaining the taste sort of that you've fostered in your meats, what are the taste profiles unique to these foods that you raise?
Well, with the White Park cattle, they're an interesting, they're a very special animal. They were the cattle of the king, of the royalty of Britain for about 800 years. Only royalty could eat them, and I guess we don't have to do too much with them. We were lucky enough to just find the breed. I bought it really because of its looks and its condition, not really its taste as much. And over time, after we slaughtered our first animal and tested it out ourselves, we found that they have a unique ability to absorb all the grasses all the different grasses and forage that they consume. You can taste the wild chives and some of the brush, the grassiness of the meat inside in the meat without it being overwhelmingly gamey or. So it's truly the best beef, I think, on the planet. I think the people that did Angus marketing 30, 40 years ago did a brilliant job, but they'd never heard of this breed. I'd be interested to compare them.
Interesting. What's the DNA that makes up the foundation for your food?
DNA, you mean the actual DNA, or do you mean like the model of the farm?
The model of the farm.
Well, it's really about the way the animals are treated and the grasses that they receive. We're in my farm, we're grass fanatics. We plant all sorts of different legumes and grasses for the animals to forage on, for the cattle to forage on especially. And the pigs get a variety of vegetables planted specifically for them. And beyond that, we really let nature, you know, run its course. If the animals receive the best quality feed, of course, they're going to produce the best quality meat. And if they're happy and, you know, comfortable in their conditions, then, of course, the less stress, the best. You know, they'll gain more fat. They won't have as much adrenaline in them, and it basically makes for a, you know, tender, more succulent meat.
So just as a human who might be stressed might actually display those symptoms physically, an animal would do very much the same thing? And
absolutely.
Those symptoms would then manifest themselves through the taste?
Sure, yeah. If an animal has high adrenaline and it's slaughtered, the meat will cut dark, it'll be tough, it'll taste terrible. You can absolutely taste that.
So it's not just sort of an urban myth?
No. It has everything to do with the animals. I mean, I don't want to be anthropomorphic, but the emotional state of the animal, you know, if it's content, if it's, you know, calving with ease and getting to get up and, you know, graze wherever it wants to, have, you know, large meadows to run through, that sort of thing. I mean, it certainly makes a difference in the quality of the food.
Can you talk to us on a biological and physiological level about how the mental well-being of an animal can actually manifest itself through the taste of the meat?
Well, I'm not a doctor. My wife is. I, as far as the physiological sense, I can tell you that, you know, how the, like I said, about how the adrenaline in the glands that's released, it gets into the bloodstream, of course, and it makes the animals tense. And so it makes their muscle fiber more more dense. And so when you have an animal that lives like that, I mean, if you think about it like a person with, you know, with a, I don't know, somebody you know that might have high stress levels or just can't really deal with their, you know, their day-to-day, they tend to clench their jaw, they tend to, you know, walk more stiffly. And if an animal acts like that, and you take that animal to the abattoir and they, you know, and they cut it, that meat's going to be tighter, that meat's going to be more tough, and it's going to have this, well, this hormone, the adrenaline that's running through it, and that hormone has a, gives off a flavor, smell, and it's not, you know, it's not good. And, I mean, most people would be surprised to find that that hormone's released in most, you know, in most of the animals that they're eating. If you're going to Kroger to buy a steak, 9 times out of 10, that animal had a pretty rough last at least 10 days of its life, and that was enough to destroy the meat.
I find that fascinating. So shifting to the future here, how will global weather patterns, do you think, affect the food you grow, if at all? And how are you going to adjust to those changing patterns?
Well, we're in a drought, actually. We've been in a drought for the last 3 years. We're coming out of it right now, I think. We've had a lot of good wet weather lately. I mean, I pay attention to what the projections are for North America and, you know, the coming decades. And really, they actually all look kind of positive to us, at least in the southern United States. I mean, it looks like we're going to have wetter, longer growing seasons. And so while it may be pretty bad for northern Europe and, you know, terrible for the west coast of Africa, it doesn't look too bad for the southeastern United States, you know, which is ironic and not, you know, kind of darkly funny, but... you know, I think that we'll probably do pretty well. We don't have to make too many adjustments except for trying to pump water, which is, I guess, it's my one crux. I haven't figured out how to get a good solar pump. It's impossible to buy a mobile, cheap solar pump. So
in terms of a long-term outlook, you think this farm's going to thrive?
I think my farm, if my children, I have 4 of them, and I'm still quite young, if they want to, I think that they would have an opportunity to triple or quadruple its size. We have a very functional model, and we have a, you know, high quality landscape. There's,
speaking of, yeah, your model, what's the maximum size for your model?
You know, I was thinking about this, and I can't imagine that there is a maximum size, except, I mean, you're restricted by the size of your land, by the amount of land you can purchase. But there's a lot of fallow land out there, a lot of old farmers that are getting out of it that don't know what to do, and they can't sell it because they're too remote. And the willingness to work it, which it's no joke. I mean, you work 18 hours a day in the sun in the summer, and it's, you know, that's tough. But, you know, the rewards are big. And I think that this model that we have here, we could export to certainly most of the Southeast and the Midwest. And I think it could function in perpetuity.
So these 18-hour days that you put in, what are you doing most of the time? Like, what's your main activity on the farm? I know this may sound like such a simpleton's question, but for non-farmers, we don't really know what you spend your days doing.
We like to talk a lot. We like to laugh at everybody else just to sit at a desk. There's a lot of crazy guys out here. There's working farms. Half the guys I know are completely nuts. I'm not quite yet one of them. I haven't been at it long enough. But you spend that much time alone in the sun, you know. I have one employee, and we raise three different types of animals plus horses for my wife. And I spend my days checking water, checking pumps. We have a 2-acre garden that we are constantly working in when everything else is not going on. You know, unfortunately, we have to deal with machinery, which breaks and is not as heavy duty as it's advertised. you know, we have, in the spring we have calving season. In the summer we have to worry about haying and getting, you know, getting the hay in. In the fall we have to worry about cutting wood and getting the wood in for the winter. In the winter we get to relax a little bit. We get to sit back and put our feet up as long as it doesn't, you know, we don't have a heavy snowstorm or, you know, or some sort of ice storms are really terrible. But, you know, we're basically just sort of crouching down and preparing for whatever the weather might throw at us next.
And who are your top buyers?
We're good half and half split between kind of the local. We're near Virginia Tech, and so we have, you know, a good supply of educated consumers who are affluent enough to, you know, support us without us having to drop our prices to where we can't be profitable. But we're not in such an nearby such an urban area where we can rely solely on that sort of customer. So we're about, you know, we're split half and half between the private local foodie who wants, you know, wants to know exactly where their food is from, and they can come by and see us, and they often do. They often, you know, come out and walk with me in the fields or pretend to work with me, you know, whatever. And then the other half, of course, is the restaurant business. We sell between Charlotte and New York. You know, half of our profits definitely go get in the truck and drive away.
Well, I certainly know that Heritage Foods values your beef very much and your pork as well. What is the 5 or 10 year plan for your farm? And where do you see it being before you pass it on to the next generation of brands?
Well, before I pass it on, it'll be paid for, which is the first thing. Most of the guys that start farming around here are in their 60s now, and their parents gave them their land, so they don't have mortgages. We have a heavy mortgage. My wife, being a doctor, helps out with that, for sure. 5 or 10 years from now, I expect that I would like us to be in a position where we have 4 or 5 restaurants that we support full stop, everything they serve, year-round, where we can deliver to them, you know, every week, which is, you know, that's kind of a tall order for a single farm to do, but I think that that's possible. We'll definitely be paying the mortgage. The farm will be paying the mortgage off, I would expect, in that time. And, you know, I expect that the farm will expand naturally, as I don't have any intent to artificially stop it from growing. But at the same, you know, I want to make sure that my breed of cattle gets spread further. There's only 4 farms in the country that have it right now, and I'd like to see it, you know, spreading locally pretty well. It's a wonderful breed, you know, and I want to make sure that my kids actually have enough time to enjoy me too. So. I don't expect that I'm going to be on the cover of any, you know, package of meat in the grocery store or anything, but, you know, we plan to make a tidy living and, you know, and still have time for the kids. They're all young now. So, yeah.
Well, that's great. Well, we'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to join us here, and I know you're one of Heritage Foods' very much valued farmers, and we hope to have a long-standing relationship with you, and I know that people really enjoy your product.
Yeah,
so your hard work is really paying off, Alec.
Thanks a lot, man.
Thanks for joining us, and we hope that this is the first of many farm reports that you'll join us on.
Sounds good.
All right, take care. Have a good day, and best of luck to you this summer.
Okay.
Bye.
See ya.
And welcome to the Farm Report here on Sunday, April 26th. We're broadcasting from Bushwick, Brooklyn, and we will be talking to one of America's leading farmers today on the Farm Report again. We ask the farmers 20 questions, and we get to put our finger on the pulse of the farming community in the United States. And today we have with us Doug Metzger of Metzger Farm. How are you, Doug?
Pretty good.
Great. Why don't you tell us a little bit about where your farm is located, what the history of your land is, and how you became connected with this land?
Well, we're at Seneca, Kansas, actually a little town of Oneida, pretty much rural, a little town of 100. And my grandfather, he bought this land that I'm on right now in 1921. And so that's just about 100 years ago. And the fellow that had it before him, and the one adjacent to it where I actually am right now, they homesteaded the land. in the 1880s, and I grew up with the farming operation. My dad came from northwest Iowa and went to farm. He married my mother and went to farm with my grandfather, and my grandfather got old in the 40s, and I was born in 1938, and I went farming with my dad when I was 18 in 1956, so I've been here for near 60 years on this same land, raising the same livestock, raising turkeys for 60 years, and cattle and hogs and milk cows. We were one of the only farms that are really diversified like all farms was back then, so that's basically my story. Well, sticking to it.
Sounds a little bit more pristine than Bushwick, Brooklyn. I envy you. Let's switch gears for a second and talk about farm laws. If you could write one issue into farm law, what would it be?
What would you mean, a law that has something to do with farm issues?
Yeah, if you could write one farm issue into law, what would it be?
Well, I would write something into law. Actually, there would be two of them. One of them would be that you couldn't have anybody come to the country and buy just an acre. They had to buy either 80 acres or nothing. So we wouldn't have this urbanization taking away our farmland. And then the other one would be that if you moved to the country, even with your 80 acres, that you could not complain about the smell of the farmers on their farm, because animals do smell, and farming is a smelly business.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And who are the members of your production chain that you interact with that are the most important to your survival?
My wife and my son and my daughter. They're all involved in the farming operation here, and my son-in-law. And basically, then I got help that helps us. And so that's what it takes.
And we know that you raise Reese turkeys on your ranch. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the taste profiles of those turkeys and about the taste profiles of the other foods you raise?
Well, these are the old-time breeds of turkeys, like been around for 100 and some years. And the hogs that I raise are the Berkshire hogs and also the Tamworth. We milk Jersey cows, which have been around a long time, and Holsteins too. So basically, you know, these animals are type of animals we used to raise the more commercial-type hogs, but we don't today anymore because of the older breeds, the meat does taste better.
Okay, and can you talk to me a little bit about how the stress of an animal affects the way the meat tastes? In other words, how you raise and how you pasture your animals, that ends up coming through in the quality and the taste of the meat. How so, biologically and physiologically speaking?
Well, I guess it's probably because they got more free land to roam around, and they aren't tight together and probably stressed, you know.
And how does the stress affect the way the meat tastes? How does the stress of an animal affect the way the meat tastes?
Well, even your cattle that you market for beefsteak, why, if you take and don't treat them nice, why, you'll have what you call dark cutters, and the meat doesn't taste as good.
Mm-hmm. What's the DNA that makes up the foundation for your food?
What do you mean by that? DNA?
Well, what's the sort of the heritage of these meats?
Well, the Tamworth hogs have been around for a long time, and the Berkshires have too. They're the older breeds that I had 50, 60 years ago, and then I started back in raising them here about 10 years ago. And the old bronze turkeys are made up, they're you might say the next step up from the wild turkeys is what they are.
And what's the 5 or 10 year plan for this farm?
Well, I kind of like keeping on just kind of how we've been here, probably maybe increasing a little bit, and maybe bringing my grandkids into it if they're interested. The girl, she's 13, and she's interested in this kind of stuff. So that's basically what it is.
Do you see yourself taking on any new kinds of pork or new kinds of turkey?
Well, probably not. Probably just like we got now.
Okay. How will How will changing global weather patterns affect the food you grow?
I don't know, really. I don't quite myself believe these here changing weather patterns, because we've had weather patterns that basically weather patterns have changed forever, and as the global warming deal, I don't know if there is such a thing, because like this last winter we had terrible cold winter, and you know, it's just a cycle of nature from one time to another, and just like we had dust bowls in the Midwest, and now they say they got the same thing in China. I just read the other day that they got the same problem with the stuff like central United States had in the 1930s, and we're a lot cooler and wetter than we were in the 1930s and even the 50s. I was a young guy in the 50s, and in the 50s we had 5 years of drought where you thought that it was going to get hotter and hotter, and it finally ended and started raining. Basically, we had 5 years of dry weather from 2000 until 2007. Was a little more than 5 years, but it wasn't as bad. But all of a sudden it started raining, and in 2007 in September, why, we ended a 5-year drought by getting 15 inches of rain in 2 weeks.
What about your farm, if anything, keeps you up at night?
Oh, I don't know. I just kind of, when I go to bed, I sleep. I really don't worry that terrible, terrible much about stuff. I think about it a lot in the daytime, but it's one of them deals. You got to learn to live with it.
And on a day-to-day level, what are some of the more problematic issues that occur on the farm?
Oh, high cost of inputs today. That's one of the biggest ones, and then also dealing with the government is a big problem on all your issues of different things that you do, and that is basically the one of the main things, you know.
What's the highest high you've had on the farm?
Oh, back in 2003, while we had a year when we stopped the Canadian beef from coming in when they had that BSE scared. And it raised the price of our cattle from 70 cents a pound to $1.15. And that made a guy feel pretty good, because we had pretty good prices then, you know. But now, this last year here, in the last 6 months, why, things have kind of went with this economy, why, everything's kind of went to the bad, and the Canadians are sending beef back in again. Not that I'm against world trade, but we're Americans here is what we are.
And what interaction does your farm have with wildlife?
One of the lows, I seen here where you had a question about the lows, and that was when our fuel went to $5 a gallon last year, and money went out of my pocket so fast you didn't know what happened.
How much fuel does your farm consume?
Oh, a tremendous amount of fuel. Anyway, you got to feed the cattle, feed the hogs, mix feed for the hogs. See, we don't buy the feed from the feed mills, we mix it our own, and so we know what ingredients get put in it and know what's good, you know, and that makes us better livestock, better meat, you know, better milk, stuff like that.
Now, where did you learn how to feed these animals properly? Was it something that you tweaked by trial and error? Was it passed down from another farmer?
Well, I studied agriculture in high school, and I went to college a little bit, and I learned how to mix feed, you might say, in nutrition, and what it takes. And it's a never-ending process. Things change, you know. So that's basically what it is.
What do you feed your hogs?
Well, we feed our hogs corn and soybean meal, and run them on pasture, you know. And wintertime is the worst time of the year, because it's hard on farm animals.
How so?
Cold, wet, snowy. You know, it's just there is no grass growing.
And what's the maximum size for your model?
My farm?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's about as big as what you can get with three family members running it. We got you know, roughly we got a couple thousand acres of what we got, which you might say is one of the smaller family farms today. There's a lot of them that are a lot bigger, you know, but basically they don't raise much livestock, you know, when you got all the different things I got, when that's about it, you know. Wildlife, when you're saying about wildlife, we got deer and we got wild turkeys and stuff like that. You know, we see them most every few days or every day sometimes.
How does technology help your farm?
I don't know. It helps, but it all comes at a cost. You know, technology does. It all comes at a cost.
Both financial and in terms of,
well, just you might say more stress, but you know, as you get bigger and try to produce some more stuff, you got more problems.
Sure.
It just is.
Who are your top buyers?
Who are my buyers?
Who are your top buyers?
Well, Heritage Foods in New York buys both hogs and turkeys from me, and they get slaughtered in Missouri and some in Kansas here. And my milk goes to a big dairy cooperative. I've looked into producing cheese, you know, and that way, but that takes a lot more work. And and my fattening cattle, they do go to Tyson's, is where they go. And the hogs and the turkeys go to Heritage Foods. I sell some hogs to another outfit called Eden Natural Pork, and they're...
So some of the cattle go where?
To the Tyson plant.
Okay.
Up at Denison, Iowa is where they go, you know.
Okay. And because of the particularities of your locale or trade, what is the secret to which only you have the key? What's a farming secret to which only you have the key?
I don't know what to say about that. That's kind of a hard question to answer. You know, I don't know. I really don't know what to say. If I hold any key to anything, I know producing these here Heritage Foods, the turkeys and the hogs, like we did 50, 60 years ago, that was key to, especially the turkeys back then. We made pretty good profits, and then as years went by, the turkeys got so commercialized that we didn't make any money anymore. And then this Heritage breeds because they taste better. So I don't know if I hold a key onto that part or not, really, you know. But it just takes a different. You got to have knowledge on how to raise these animals outside like that, which you know, most of the big operations, they don't know that anymore. If you call that a key, really.
What to you is American food?
To me, what American food? Fried chicken and country ham and beefsteak.
Mm. And so you're saying basically the meat's indigenous to this area?
Well, yeah, to America and turkey. Turkey's, you know, I've always liked turkey and geese too. I like goose and ducks too, really. And that was my ones like my grandma, and I raised ducks when I was a little kid, way back in the 1950s. So any of those, you know, any of those foods I call American.
So you've had a farmer in you for quite some time.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
All right, great. Well, we'd like to thank you so much for joining us here. We know that the people over at Heritage and our customers really, really do enjoy the Metzger products. And we hope that we'll have you on for many times to come.
Okay.
We really appreciate that. Thank you, Doug.
Okay.
Have a nice one.
Yep. Thank you.
Bye.